Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote, "Who trusted God with love indeed? And love's creation's final law. Though nature, red in tooth and claw, with ravine shrieked against his creed." There's the context of nature, red in tooth and claw, and it's part of how we regard nature in very different kinds of ways from generation to generation and from different times in our own lives, how we relate to the natural world. There's a very famous painting by Raphael called The School of Athens, and it has a picture of Plato and of Aristotle together, teacher and student. Plato pointing up towards the sky, the realm of the ideal, the immaterial and the eternal, and Aristotle pointing down to the earth, the land of land, the land of where our bodies live and of nature. And in this portrait, there really is an indication of what we take as a dichotomy, as a split between that ideal realm and the sky, the realm that religion so often deals with, the eternal, the spiritual, and in contradistinction, look at the earth as somehow the dirt and the temporary and the less noble part of nature, the less eternal part of nature. And we have this split about these two different parts of nature, these two different experiences that are equally important and valid in our lives. We look at the sky and we search the stars for signs and portents. We look at the earth and try to figure out how the world works. What can we do here? It's not that they are two foreign lands, foreign to one another. We are united in both. We are body and spirit. We have this ineffable, if whether eternal or temporary, consciousness that is miraculous. We are spirit and we are mud and we are blood, or as the song adds, and beer. We are all of these things and we live in all of these places, and yet we go back and forth between those two realms as if they were strangers one to another. I was thinking about all of this during my vacation on Maui. That's why I'm talking about it. It makes it a deductible vacation in Maui. We were looking at the skies. We were looking up and we were looking down. We were looking up constantly at the remarkable sunsets, at clouds scudding across the sky, covering Molokai, watching them change color from white clouds to pink clouds to red clouds, as if there were fire in the sky. And then as the sun set even lower, or for the scientists amongst you, as the earth continued to revolve, I'm good either way, we watched first the fixed stars and then the planets, then Venus, pop out into the sky. And as it grew darker and darker, the sky grew lighter and brighter with stars. Stars that we don't see here. Stars that are covered in our fog and our smog and in all of the ambient light that comes out from our cities and from our towns. And they're still there, those stars. They're still in the sky, whether we can see them or not. They are objective facts that don't depend on our seeing them for their existence. As it grew darker and brighter at the same time, we looked at all the patterns in the sky. We tried to figure out which were the constellations that we could name. And we looked, and it was pretty easy to find Orion's Belt, which is part of Ursa minor and to find Ursa Major over on the other side, and to look at all of these wonderful constellations and to know that they exist and don't exist at two levels. We create the constellations, but we don't create the stars. The stars are real and objective, and the patterns that we see, the patterns that we impose, help us make some sense, draw some order from this wild and wonderful chaos of life. And as I looked at the constellations, and as we talked about which was which, we also realized that not only are our constellations not objective, but they are culturally and time-specific. People other than Greeks and other than the Arab astronomers, Norse astronomers, African astronomers, people in Australia who gazed up at the sky, came up with different patterns and with different names. How much of that is true of our religions and of our philosophies? That we look at the same objective realities and we come up with different poems, different patterns, different meanings, and so we'll fight. We'll fight about, well, is that Orion's belt or are those the Pleiades? Or is that a bear or is it a rabbit? Where we are looking at these from our cultural eyes and our geographical eyes determines to some extent, to a large extent, what it is that we see in the immense beauty of the sky. We look up at the sky and those peaceful stars are twinkling above. And yet we know that those peaceful stars are nuclear, thermonuclear explosions, power beyond human imagining, numbers beyond what we can imagine numbers to be, are the stars in the skies, are the power that we are seeing in those quiet, silent, twinkling stars. What a miracle creation is. What a miracle life is, that there are stars and that there are people to perceive them, to wonder at them, to try to understand them, to be moved by the poetry, and not have the poetry diminished by the view of science, by understanding. That I can understand, in principle, if not in fact, why the clouds change colors doesn't diminish the experience or the poetry. That I can understand, in theory, in principle, the stars and the nuclear and thermonuclear reactions doesn't diminish the wonderment of it all. To lay there and look at the skies, to see the stars, to see the shooting stars, to wonder at it all. My friend Bob, who was our host, said, you know, if you don't have good explanations, you come up with stories. Yeah, you come up with stories. I completely understood how our primitive ancestors and some of our contemporaries would look at the relationship of the moon to the tides and figure that there was some kind of magic going on as the waxing moon and the waning moon had some effect on high tide and low tide. I could understand how our Greek ancestors and Roman ancestors looked at the sun as it went overhead and then set usually in the west, and they thought that it was being dragged along by Phaeton's chariot. That's no more fanciful than my understanding of gravity and the invisible forces of the moon and its effect on the tide, or the mind-boggling, light-bending power of the sun's gravitational field. Our explanations may be another generation's stories, and they're all part of the wonder of nature and our relationship to this mystery that we live, that we experience, that we celebrate. But I didn't just look up. I also looked down. Was skin diving, not scuba, doing freehold breath diving in the wonderful clear waters off of Lanai and Maui, looking down 30, 40, 50, 60 feet at this wonderful world that is not our world, a world where I was at first a stranger and an interloper. And then I dove down, just turned, stuck my feet in the air, and went down and cruised along with the fish, flew down through the reefs, and looked at this explosion of color, of red coral, of black coral, of pink coral, of fish of every kind of color and shape, and fish that do just amazing things. Fish that change color in order to fit in with their environment and disguise themselves as rocks so that they can reach out and grab their prey. Fish that looked like saucers. Fish that were colored orange and gold and green. Fish that looked like parrots. Fish that looked like other kinds of birds, fish that looked like snakes, fish that looked like trumpets and needles and coronets. There were even some fish on that reef that looked like fish. It was really remarkable. There were fish that not only changed colors, but they changed gender. Not just the color of gender, but their actual gender. Take that, Tea Party people. Nature is wonderful in its ability to shift shape, to surprise, to fool, to entice, to entertain. You look at those wonders and you just are filled with a sense of awe. Now, as I dove deeper and deeper, I stayed underwater longer and longer and felt less an interloper and more a marine mammal. We human beings have what's called a mammalian diving reflex. This is different from the reflux that I normally experience. And that is, as we dive, like our cousins, the whales and the dolphins, our heart rates slow down. From 30% to 50%, depending on the temperature of the water, your own sense of ease with it, and the depth. Standing here, I'm not going to try it out in front of you because I hate a minute and a half of dead silence, but I can hold my breath standing here for about 90 seconds without too much strain. If I'm walking about, I can hold my breath for maybe 20 seconds without too much strain. At 30 feet below the sea, I could hold my breath easily for a minute and a half. I am, make your own joke, a cousin to the whale, a cousin to all of those cetaceans. I am, as you are, a part of, not apart from, nature. I have within my DNA, as you have within your DNA, this relationship with the rest of nature, with other mammals, with aquatic mammals, with land mammals, all of this evolution that we have gone through that brought us to this moment, to this time under the sun, is the sum of all of these changes, all of these things that we have inherited that make us a part of nature. For much too much of human history, we have looked at nature in either-or terms. We've looked at it sometimes sentimentalizing Mother Nature. Oh, Mother Nature is wonderful, and it's great, and it's grand, and we are nothing. We are interlopers. We don't deserve anything, and nature is just good, and we're bad. I find this to be an extreme view. Nature is good and wonderful and red in tooth and claw. Nature is not a moral agent. We are moral agents. There was an old poem that used to get read in the 60s called Desiderata that talked about, I have a right to be here. I think the ecological view that sometimes says we have no right to be here and everything we do and take is destructive and we are all sinners is an overstatement. We are not nature's master, nor are we just a bug. We are moral agents. For too many times we have just looked at nature as it is good, we are bad. And I remind you, as I have in the past, that to call nature good is to believe that because Socrates drank 100% organic hemlock, it had to have been good for him. Not the case. There were no additives. There were no fertilizer. There was no genetic mutation. It wasn't some kind of Franken crop. It was natural hemlock, and it killed him pretty dead. Nature can do that to you, red in tooth and claw. But it's not evil. It is not a moral agent. We are the moral agents. We are the moral agents that don't have to say we are the masters of nature, and it is our job to cut down the mountains for our own use, to take all of the fish for our own selfish use, to believe that it is infinite and it will always recover and that we have no responsibility for what is called stewardship is also an extreme and, in my view, an inappropriate and not factual position to take. There's a wild river, let's dam it. There's something that we can use, let's harvest it, let's burn it. This is not working well with our world. We don't have to be either the boss, having been given in our Western scripture dominion over the earth, a bad mistake on God's part if you're going to take that literally, nor are we simply an infestation. We are, as far as we know, may not be true, but as far as we know, the only moral agents on the planet, where we have choices about what we take, what we put back, whether we clean up our own mess or not, whether we bring an attitude of dominion or of slavery or of partnership. And I suggest to you that the image of being a partner in the creation, the appreciation, and the sustaining of nature is our highest calling ecologically. If we simply feel sinful for being here, I don't think that we will react in the most constructive way. If we seem simply overpowering of nature, I don't think, and the record seems to prove, that we will not act in the best ways for either nature, such as it is, or ourselves. But to find a modus vivendi, a way of living together with our world, with the mountains, with the skies, with the seas, not to fill them carelessly with our effluence, not to simply assume that they will be fine and leave it to another generation, but to do our part, to appreciate it, to appreciate the wonder that we live under these stars, to appreciate the light and the life and the consciousness that we carry, to hear, to recite, to appreciate the poetry of nature, and at the same time explore nature for reasons, for causes, for fixes, for repair. One of the great lines in therapy is the challenge that we human beings have, which is repeat or repair. We have done a lot of repeating in terms of our relationship to the natural world. It's time to get to the repair part, to fixing how it is that we interact with our natural world, how we make conscious choices about what we take, what we leave, what we put back, and how we appreciate it. Nature, red in tooth and claw, human beings with a potential for being green, we are the moral agents. We add the value, we add the values to nature. They may not be inherent. Like the stars are real, but we impose the patterns. We take our values and we make them real through the choices that we make with our lives. How we spend, how we take, how we save, how we build, how we destroy, ultimately, how we love each other and our world that we share above and below in this precious time.